Welcome to the Tao of Color Grading interview series, where we talk with influencers, thought leaders, and professionals about the field of color grading for moving images. Show notes, links, our free weekly newsletter, and our color training products can be found at taoofcolorgrading.com. And I'm your host, Patrick Inhofer. Welcome to part two of our interview with writer, producer, editor, and sometime colorist Steve Hullfish. We'll be talking about Steve's Class on Demand training DVD, its origin and unique approach, scopes, dirty little secrets, control surfaces, and the value of color grading, and more. Let's pick up where we last left off. So now let's move on to your latest work, which is the Class on Demand training for Apple Color. Now, that was released this past summer, summer of 2010, and, this is interesting in that, there are lots of training DVDs out there. There's lots of training, all sorts of training that's out on the web. And one way that yours is unique is that it's a two-person deal. There's you with your old friend Bob Sliga, and you're talking about Apple Color, and Bob happened to be on the original Final Touch team and later worked for Apple for a couple of years with Apple Color. And so my question to you is, who came up with that notion of teaming up a writer with a really experienced colorist who also happens to have been, a software developer?
Well, I hate to take credit for something, but it's like I think Mark Twain said, it ain't bragging if it's true.
Yep.
I came up with that idea.
That's fantastic.
The way that it worked out, actually, Bob's involvement with the Final Touch team was through me.
Oh, no kidding.
Because what happened was I was going to write a review of Final Touch. And they sent me, this was before I wrote The Art and Technique of Color Correction. I wrote this review on Final Touch. And they sent me this copy of this thing, and I opened it up, and like most people that have looked at color, this was 4 years previous.
Yeah.
So this thing is like fresh out of Unix. Everything is like Unix code. The version I got didn't have file menus. There was nothing at the top of the screen. There were no pull-down menus at the top of the screen. That is how Unix-y this thing was. And I didn't even know what to do. I didn't know where to begin. I mean, people now look at color. Like, there's all kinds of people that they open it up and they go like, oh, forget it.
Yep.
This was the same experience for me, only way worse.
Right.
And I called up Bob Sliga and I go, Bob, you got to check this thing out. I think this is the most powerful thing that there is out there on the desktop right now, but I don't know what to do with it. You got to come over here and check this out. Well, Bob comes over and he's like, okay, where's the manual? I'm like, there is no manual. There was no file. There was no help menu. There was no manual. There were no file menus. I mean, it was a nightmare. And the two of us sat in my basement with a bunch of 2K footage and on a Mac, on an old, like the original Mac G5. And all of a sudden, Bob is like giggling like a schoolgirl. He's like, this thing's got more power than my DaVinci. Oh my gosh, this is amazing. I can't believe I'm sitting in your basement and we're doing this. Holy smokes. And he is just color correcting stuff and adding like 20 windows onto things and doing all this. He goes, I couldn't do this with a $5 million suite. And he was just blown away, other than the fact that I had a crappy, NTSC standard def monitor. He couldn't believe it. And he fell in love with it. And before he left that night, he said, I'm going to figure out a way to quit my job. I'm going to buy one of these systems and start my own shop. That was in one night.
Yep.
He had pulled the trigger on jumping to Final Touch. And because he was a fairly experienced guy and I knew the Final Touch guys from a couple of meetings I had with them at NAB, and I'd even tried to set Avid up. I'm like, look at this color correction thing. I know Symphony's nice, but you should do something. You should buy this.
Yep.
I talked to the wrong company, obviously. And so I talked with the engineers, and I put them in touch with Bob Sliga. And so then Bob started doing demos, and he started doing training for them, and he started helping write manuals and doing all the stuff. And then he got hired. So And then he got, I think he got hired by Final, I don't think he did. He was working as a consultant for Final Touch, if I'm correct. And then he got hired by Apple.
Actually,
you know, I don't want to claim credit, but that, you know, Bob moving to Final Touch and meeting Apple and Final Touch and all those guys, that was through me. And then the way Class on Demand works is that they don't pay anything for those DVDs. The basic deal is just they give you a, there's no upfront money. They just give you a better cut than anybody else. So you've got to, as a trainer, you've got to say, are enough people going to want to buy this that this is going to be worth my effort?
Right.
Because it's going to take me a week to shoot it in the studio. Class on Demand does everything else. They're very good at marketing. They do all of the editing. They do all of the graphics. They do all of the coding and Flash programming and all that stuff.
They're offering it online now as well, right?
Right. And it's up online. And so they do all of that stuff. They also, a lot of that stuff gets sold through resellers. So they get, you know, mass sales instead of, you know, one DVD at a time. So that's the reason why I chose Class on Demand. But those picking that title was just me saying there needs to be a good color training DVD. And I felt like the best person to do that was, one, I wanted to do it, and I'd been on it since Final Touch, and I knew that Bob was a great, you know, he had obviously been part of the company, and nobody knows that application better than Bob. I mean, there's nobody in the world that knows that application better than Bob. And so between the two of us, I figured kind of my writing skills and kind of my brand from writing these two books would help, and Bob's technical skills, and also, you know, I've been on, you know, basically I've been on color for 2 years before it became color, so I knew the application pretty well too, and I figured it would just be an unbeatable combination, and it would be fun to knock things back and forth. Sometimes when you're a solo presenter, you forget things or you gloss over something. Like Bob would say something, and I would realize that he was kind of skipping a step because he knows it so well.
Right.
So I would point that out. You know, I go, oh, yeah, but don't you, you know, you got to explain to people that you pushed that button before you did that, or this parameter was already set up, and that's the only way that you were able to do it. That's right. And he would remind, and then he would do the same thing to me. I would start explaining something, and he would either say, oh, but there's a better way to do it, or have you ever tried this? So it's really a very complete training compared to other DVDs, just because two brains are always better than one. I mean, it's just, no matter, even if you could present with yourself, you'd be better off than presenting at one time alone.
Well, and I'll tell you, I mean, and that definitely comes across in watching down the training. You know, you have two sets of DVDs. There's the basic training and then the advanced training. And they're sold separately, and I think Class on Demand bundles them together as well,
yep,
right?
They do, and it's like a 50% discount if you buy them together.
Right, and I can tell you, you know, the first thing I noticed was how well that interaction worked, because you guys would start riffing off of each other, and I noticed that, you know, it was clear that, you know, Bob is definitely the hands-on guy, right? He's the guy driving the software the whole time. Yep. But you're pretty much there, and you're making sure that he covers all the right points. You're making sure if he starts to drift or if he misses something, you do a really great job of coming in and saying, well, what about this? And frankly, and then that also goes the other way around, where you might start a discussion on something, then he brings up a topic. And I really enjoyed that, especially, and I think that really comes through on the advanced training, where you get beyond just talking about the basic interface. And when you guys start talking technique, I kind of feel like, you know, we're all hanging out and the only thing missing was a couple beers.
And right. You can bring the beer too. We're actually thinking about bundling it with a six pack.
Well, you know, it would work that way, let me tell you.
No, that's definitely the feel we were looking for, and it's the feel I think we got. Luckily, Bob and I are, I mean, we've known each other for over a decade. We've hung out together a lot. We're not best friends by any means. Not that I wouldn't want to be best friends with Bob. I love the guy dearly. He's a great musicians have this word, you know, that you're a great hang.
Right.
Bob's a great hang. You just want to hang out with the guy and sit around and chat. That's the kind of guy he is. And that's the sense that I really like about that training DVD series, is that you're just hanging out, and we're not just talking about nothing.
Yep.
We're talking all the time. It's a focused discussion of the issues, but it's not so dry. Right. I mean, a lot of times, and I've listened to a lot of training, you know, but I really like when it's, have you ever watched Layers TV?
No, I have not.
Adobe, Adobe has Kelby Training and Adobe have a magazine called Layers, which is all about every single Adobe application.
Right.
Which is why they call it Layers, because almost all the Adobe applications have layers.
Right.
And but then there's also a video, a weekly podcast called Layers TV, and it's two guys. And it's so much fun to have them. And they're both very experienced at all the Adobe apps. And I've met them a couple of times. But it just feels like you're hanging out with some other creative individuals. And in today's environment, we are becoming increasingly isolated from other professionals, right? Yeah. You're by yourself pretty much.
Yep.
I'm by myself pretty much. Bob is pretty much by himself now. So many editors and colorists and graphic artists, where we used to be in this huge, you know, you were at HBO, right?
Yep.
You could sit and, you know, when you were done with an editor at lunchtime, you'd go sit with a dozen other editors or three or four other editors and a colorist and maybe an engineer.
Yep.
There'd be all this chatter that went on. Now you don't get any of that. And so I really like the fact that when you sit down and watch this training, it's like, hey, I finally have a social life.
Or at least it feels like one, or at least I'm hanging with someone who has a social life.
Right. It's kind of pathetic that it's on DVD, but you know, it's like colorist porn.
Yeah, exactly. Otherwise known as Transformers. So what you're telling me about how the class on demand thing works, then you had a full hand in how the training is structured.
I mean, class on demand doesn't do anything at all up front. You show up in their studio on a given day and they just turn on the cameras and start the camera and start the capture. That is it.
Because I got to say, what I really like, and I'll be writing up a review on this, and for me, the thing that I think is really important to anyone who's interested in deepening their understanding of color or more importantly, the craft of color grading. And it comes through in all of your books, and it comes through on this class on demand, is where you place understanding scopes. In your basics training, it's like the second thing you hit. You know?
It's got to be.
I mean, it's like right there at the top. In your books, it's right there at the top. And I think a lot of people discount just how important scopes are to the craft of color grading.
Yeah. Well, you probably know that I went out on tour this last summer for Tektronix. They had a bunch of free seminars around the country talking about their scopes, and they had me as a presenter in seven cities. And Steve Bays, who's the product manager for Final Cut, came out because he said he'd been having struggles explaining to his engineers why scopes mattered and why they needed them and why they needed to be better. And he said, I came out for, you know, ammunition, basically. A lot of people are afraid of scopes. I kind of don't want you to say how important they are in the book and the DVD training, because people are like, oh, I'm not buying that DVD series. It's going to talk about scopes. I don't want that. You have to realize that when I'm talking about them, it's not as a technical, oh, here's the breezeway and the back porch, and notice the blanking is at 0500 megahertz. You know, I don't do any of that stuff. It's all how to use them as a creative tool, how to see what you need to see to be able to manipulate the image correctly in the scope.
Right.
That's what it's for.
Right.
And it is critical. I make a joke all the time. Those people have heard me speak a couple of times are probably sick of me saying it, but I say, you know, my wife would tell anybody that I couldn't get dressed by myself, but if I had a waveform and vector scope in my closet, I'd actually be able to choose clothes that matched. I can't do it with my eyes, but you know.
That's exactly right. Now let me ask you, because a lot of people will come to color grading and they'll say, well, I'm not good with colors. So do you need to be good with colors, having talked to all these colorists, to be a good colorist?
No. One of the things that a couple of people have asked me about, or like when they've mentioned, you know, they've seen me do training, or I do a lot of one-on-one training with companies. I'm going out to Versus Network in a couple of weeks. I go to Turner Network a couple of times a year. I was just out at a place called Respond to Post doing color correction training for their editors. And they say, oh, well, you know, what about color theory? And to me, honestly, the more I know about color theory, the less it has to do with what a colorist does.
Right, right.
Just honestly, you need some very basic color theory, basically to know what complementary colors are and what the primary colors are, and that's it.
Yep.
I explain in the courses that almost everything you need to know about color theory, you can learn from a vectorscope. Yep. Here's the RGB, and in between them are magenta and yellow and cyan, and where they're positioned tells you a lot about color theory and what's opposite them and what colors they're between, what primary colors they're between. You have to read the book to get a better explanation of what I'm trying to say, but
yep.
color theory, you don't worry about.
And if you don't mind me plugging a different book, Dan Margulies has Color Correction for Photoshop.
I own that book. Yep, that's a great book.
It's a fantastic book, and his premise in the first four chapters is, I can teach a colorblind person how to color correct.
I think, you know, when you were starting down this road, I was going to say just that.
Yep.
I don't think it's quite true, because obviously you wouldn't inspire a lot of confidence in many people,
yeah,
as a colorist,
yeah,
if you were colorblind. But, you know, that's the scopes. Like, if you can look at a scope, you can see where every single color is and every single tonal range. A lot of color correction isn't even about color so much as it is about tonal range and spreading and expanding tonal range in certain parts of the picture to help focus the audience's attention on something. So a lot of it is just having a good sense of what's dark and what's bright and where the middle ground should lie. So you don't need, you could be colorblind and do that, and then the rest of the color blindness wouldn't matter too much because you've got scopes.
Right. Now, when you were working with other colorists and you're interviewing them, there's a lot of derision oftentimes given to the vignette, you know, the kind of soft edge darkening around the edges of the picture. In your experience, do most of the colorists you've been talking to, do they kind of fall in one or two camps? I use them all the time, or I never use them?
That actually is one of those things that I learned when you were asking me about writing the second book, and what did I learn? One of them is that every colorist is kind of embarrassed about vignettes, like, oh, this is just a trick,
right,
but they all use them. So
they,
it's
all
like
use them.
Everybody's dirty little secret is, oh, vignettes, oh, you know, you should never do that, but I do it all the time.
They work, you know, and if you do it well, you may not even notice it. You know, right. I've noticed sometimes in my, what's that?
Right, that's of course what they all say, is
right,
you should not notice this effect. But I mean, I've watched spots on TV where you're like, holy cow, half the screen is black,
yeah,
you know, the vignette is so strong. And sometimes that does work.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of creating a look. How graphic is it? How much are you trying to focus the audience's attention? I don't think you should see a vignette, but I'll tell you, when you toggle a vignette off and on,
yep,
sometimes you can't see it when it is on there, but when you toggle it off, you're like, whoa, that really helped.
Exactly.
So I think a lot of colorists are actually embarrassed that they use vignettes, but all of them do it.
All right, so now let's switch gears and talk about everyone's favorite topic, control surfaces.
is that everyone's favorite topic?
It's one of my favorite topics, I can tell you that. And so I just extrapolate to the rest
of it. Would be.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the big question. Can you be a professional colorist and not have a control surface, in
yes,
your opinion? Yes.
I don't think you want to be.
Right.
I think the biggest issue is just the amount of time it takes.
Right.
I think you'd have a hard time making a living as a professional colorist if you didn't have a control surface, just because it would take you so much longer to do the work that eventually people will go, oh my gosh, this guy took, you know, it took me 3 days to get this thing done, and somebody else could have done it in a half a day.
But if you're charging one-third his rate.
well, if you're charging a third of his rate and it took you a fourth of the time, or, you know, four times the time, then you're still more expensive.
You're still more expensive. Yeah, I mean, I guess at a certain point, right. you've got to discount your rate to take that into effect.
There is a break-even point. Right. And, you know, as long as you can be under whatever that break-even point is, then you're fine. But if you haven't worked with a control service, you don't know how fast you could work.
Right.
I mean, you would be – I mean, you know, because you've done it, but yep. – It is stunning how fast you can color correct an image when you have a control service. And one of the things, one of the interesting sidebars, I think it's my favorite part of the Art and Technique book, is a less than one page thing on budgeting time, basically how long it takes to do color correction.
Right.
And that was me having all these interviews with all these colorists saying, how long do you actually have to do something? And some of these guys were feature guys, some of them were spot guys, some of them were doc guys, some of them were primetime colorist guys. And so I got a really good sense of exactly how long it should take to do color correction. A lot of these guys are doing high-end color correction, and some of it is like 30 seconds a grade.
Yeah.
That's fast. Yeah. And there is no way you can do a grade in 30 seconds.
With a mouse.
30 seconds with a mouse.
Yeah.
Just not going to happen.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because when I got my first control surface a couple of years ago, I had been grading on a mouse, but it was more of an extension of my editorial services. So, you know, you'd hire me as an editor, and then I'd convince you to spend some extra money for a couple of days for me to grade. And I kept a bit of a diary, it's online, of my move to a control surface. And what I found is you pair that up with something like color, or now a resolve, and not only do you get more speed, and not only do you get more quality, but you just overall get a much better experience. You become, it really lifts your ability to deliver above average work.
Right. Well, it gives you great flow. I mean, flow is a little bit more important to an editor, but when you're in the midst of doing color correction, just the ability, and if you, there's one of the things in the basic and advanced training on that color class on demand DVD is showing how to set up the wave and use the wave,
yep.
Tangent Devices wave panel. And if you're using it like Bob uses it in that presentation, you're flying.
Yeah.
You know, you're just flying along. And it makes it so much nicer. If you're not struggling at something, you do better work.
Yep.
You know, there's a great – I just got a book from Steve Cohen, who's an editor. I can find the book. Here it is. Called Avid Agility.
Ah, yes. That just came out, right?
Yeah. And there's a great quote in the front of this book. I'm going to read it to you. It says – this is a quote from Abraham Lincoln. Okay, and you would think that a book on Avid editing would not start with a quote from Abraham Lincoln, but here it is. If I had 8 hours to chop down a tree, I'd spend 6 sharpening my axe.
Right.
So there is your control surface quote right there.
Right. Right. Now, there are, I guess, really 3 main control surfaces that people can go out and buy that are affordable. I mean, like sub $10,000.
Are you including the iPad?
Well, you know, it is a $600 control surface when you get down to it.
Yeah.
Do you have a preference?
Do I have a preference? Yeah. I truly like those Tangent Devices. I had an Eclipse for about a year, and I did like it better than I liked the original Eclipse. I thought it was a nice, smooth surface. It was very big, but it and it had difficulty staying connected. If you know anything about a lot of these control surfaces, the better ones use some kind of IP connection through the Ethernet. And I found that I was losing my connect. I would, you know, log on to Color and start to work, and I'd be like, I'd spend 15 minutes trying to get it to find the control surface. So I do have some problems with that. The Wave is very nice. It's quick to use. I don't, you know, the feel of it isn't as nice. I like, you know, I like having a nice, heavy, solid, beautiful touch. Your hands are on the thing all day, right? So you don't want it to, you want it to have a nice, they call it in the textile industry, a hand,
right.
The way something feels. And the Wave really doesn't have that. But for the price,
yeah,
and for the actual what it allows you to do, the actual its ability to do the work, it's incredible.
Right.
My favorite, you know, was the couple of months that I had that CP100, which I think at the time was $20,000 or something.
Yeah, people rave about that one.
Yeah, and then if you break the CP100 down into its component parts, those are the CP200s, and those have a beautiful feel to them. They look sharp. They're really nice. They're just a little expensive. That's all, you know. Like I said, I've been on the Eclipse. The Eclipse is better than it used to be. If you like J.L. Cooper, you know, that Eclipse is a fine piece to do what you got to do. I just had some operational issues with it.
They've gotten better on that. Their software has gotten better. They still have a problem with about once a day when I'm using that panel, about once a day I've got to kind of quit out of color and start it back up again just to reestablish connectivity to the surface.
Right.
It'll just stop working. But
And to me, and I understand that, and it's difficult, but that's not a rave review.
It's not. I mean, you know, and it's tough because it's also the most expensive of, you know, the three or four, if you include the iPad that we're talking about. And to have to be able to do that, I've got a long-term loan from Euphonics on the MC Color, and I pretty much never have to, I don't have that issue with it. And it's also IP-based. It's you know, I've got a router that
well,
feeds
I mean, it's all software, man. Yeah. If you write good software, then you're golden.
Yeah, the nice thing I found about the Eclipse is it gives you more access to more of the submenus. So in Apple's Color, if you're in the secondary room, there are like four sub-tabs. And you can toggle between those, as well as you can just directly jump to whichever secondary you want. So they've built a lot of that functionality in there, whereas on the MC Color, I don't have quite the access to all of those commands.
I'm pretty sure you can do that on a Wave, though.
You can. Okay. I haven't tried it yet.
The Wave, that's the other thing that I like about the Wave. And go check this out. This is definitely a truism of those panels, is the ability to customize them. The Wave has one of the nicest pieces of software to say, okay, I want this dial to do this.
Right.
I want to press this button. I want that to jump me into all these tabs. I want to set it up so that I'm almost always in this tab or in this order. And all of the dials and knobs, you can give them exact names, whatever name you want to give it. That's what one of the things that I really like about the Tangent Wave is the ease and the UI, basically, of setting up what your preferences are.
Now, have you talked to people, because you say you do a lot of training, have you talked to people about, you know, who are just getting onto, let's say, a control surface, and then have you had subsequent conversations where about how long it takes for people to get up to speed on a control surface?
No, because almost all the color correction training that I do with people is to editors, and almost all those guys are just using
a mouse.
I do the training that I do at Turner. They just got a control surface, but it's only one guy that uses it, and we weren't in that room when I did the training.
So now let's start wrapping this up. I've taken quite enough of your time. You've been very generous with it with me this morning.
It's great to talk to you, Patrick.
Oh, thanks. We are now, I see this thread of conversation all the time, and it's asked to me from time to time. I want to get your perspective on it. That, you know, we're now the YouTube generation, Vimeo, where story counts, your audio can be good, your audio has to be good, but your video, it doesn't matter as long as you've got a good story and people can hear it. So in this day and age, what's the relevancy of color grading in your estimation?
Well, it's a little bit of a good question.
Thank you.
But at the same point, I think that you want to do the best job you can do no matter what. And this has always been the case of, you know, some low-end technology like YouTube. I mean, not that that's low-end technology, but the expectations of a YouTube video or a Vimeo video are pretty low. But at the same time, anything that you do that helps your audience, one, make your product look better, and two, helps your audience stay in the story, that's what you need to do. Sure, you know, if I wanted to, I could tell you a story, you know, over this Skype line. You know, there would be no video involved. There would be no color correction involved. I could tell you a great story and maintain your attention, and you'd end up going, wow, that was a great story. I didn't have to have video at all. But if you're going to do video, sure, you can do it with no quality whatsoever. But the more quality you do, you know, the better your product's going to look, the more proud you are of it, the better your audience is going to be. But you've always had these ways to tell stories that don't require, you know, huge quality.
Now, and I completely agree with everything you've just said there. And but if I'm an editor and I'm looking at the three-way color corrector, and I use, you know, I use my eyedroppers all the time. Why should I think about color grading, learning this stuff? I mean, how's it can be relevant? You say you go down to Turner, and you're probably dealing with the editorial staff out in Atlanta or something like that. What's the advantage of putting that, you know, taking the time to learn that?
Well, I think for somebody that, I mean, your original question was about YouTube, for example.
Right.
Everyone is aspirational. That's what I think. That no matter what you're doing now, you aspire to something more. If you're putting up a video on YouTube, you want to be Steven Spielberg.
Right.
You know, you want to be James Cameron. You want to do Avatar. You want to do Titanic. You want to, you know, you want to do Transformers. That's your goal. Nobody's goal is to deliver something through YouTube for the rest of their life.
Right.
That's not it. That might be what you're doing. That might actually make you money or whatever, you know, it might, you know, help your creative outlet, but you want something better for your product. And color correction is something that just consistently delivers that something better. I always use the analogy, I use it in the books, of between color and music. Both of them, I mean, imagine a movie without music.
Right.
You know, imagine almost anything on YouTube without music. I mean, right. Skateboard videos, you know, you watch these guys skating around. And if they didn't have some kind of, you know, funky, edgy, you know, indie rock rap thing underneath those videos, you'd be like, oh, this is boring. Color does the same thing. It helps an audience get a sense of the meaning. It gives a sense of edginess. It gives a sense of attitude. It gives a sense of emotion. It does all these same things that music helps you do. I mean, you wouldn't do a skateboard video and put, you know, the Carpenters underneath of it, you know.
Yep.
You wouldn't put Barry Manilow under a skating video. Why not? You know, you could cut a skateboard video to Barry Manilow if you wanted to, but that's not the feel that they want.
Right.
They want an edgy street feel. And just like you can do an edgy street feel for a skating video with edgy, you know, indie rock music, you can also do that same thing with the video. You can, you know, make the contrast and the colors and make stuff that it's got that same sense visually that it has musically.
And so along the same lines then, as a guy who yourself, you tend to be involved in productions from beginning to end, are there ways and techniques and tricks that you use when you're shooting to ensure that you have flexibility at the back end if you want to come up with that edgy look that gives you the latitude you need to make sure you can actually manipulate your images?
Yeah, I am a little bit more of a chicken when it comes to just because I know I'm in charge of the post. I mean, a lot of times, you know, when you're out there, you're going to hand it over to some editor. You know, maybe you're not going to be completely involved in the entire production process. I know I'm going to be involved in the complete production process. So I tend to go, you know, I love production quality. I always pay for the best crew I can get, the best camera I can get. I put my money in that spot because I believe in it. But I also don't tend to lock into a specific look in the field because, one, sometimes I repurpose stuff, and two, because I feel like I can do enough to it in post, and I don't, and I like to be in post, that's where I tend to do stuff. So I go for a much flatter, more even base look in the field than setting some like funky look in the camera and saying, now I don't have to worry about it.
Right. So you'll protect your highlights, protect your shadows.
Yep,
a bit.
Exactly. Protect my highlights, protect my shadows. Don't do anything crazy with color correction. I, You know, there were times when I really loved a really warm image, and I would have guys putting, you know, filtration and all kinds of stuff on the lens. And then a couple of projects, I found that I needed to fight that, and it was harder to fight than if I'd just done it by itself.
Right.
And if I want to apply that warm look or a soft focus look or something, I can just as easily do it in post. And it's not that I want to fix problems in post, but I want to have more chance to mold the piece later than earlier.
Right.
And that just might be me being too lazy to have a vision at the front.
Right.
But that's the way I do it.
That's well, Steve. Thank you very much. What do you have coming up? You've got a second edition of the digital, the Art and Technique.
Right. Okay. That's a full year from me even delivering it to the publisher. So don't look for that anytime soon. But I have already started doing more grading sessions. I did I did grading sessions with two of the greats. Out in L.A., Bob Festa, who is like the legendary godfather of color correction, and also Stefan Sonnenfeld, who, you know, has done virtually everything you've seen on screen in the last 10 years. Interviews with both those guys and sat in on color sessions with them. So,
well,
and a couple other guys as well.
But I will say that, you know, the first edition of the book is very evergreen. And so there's no reason to hold out and wait on it if you think you can learn something from it.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely one of those things that I there was a point where I was, when I knew I was writing the second edition of the first book, where I was actually steering people away from buying the first edition just because by that point I was so unhappy with it.
Right.
You know, you originally write a book and you're like, wow, I wrote a book. This is the greatest thing. And then with that one, I've kind of fallen out of love with the book by that time. Now with the second edition, I like it again. Art and Technique, that's been out for several years. I don't know, at least three, I think. And I still am very, very proud of that book. And it's still a great book. What's going to happen with that is just there's going to be more examples from more colorists. I'll drop some of the, you know, lesser colorists or guys that I used three or four times in the book, and they'll only be in it once, and we'll make room for the Bob Festas and the Stefan Sonnenfelds of the world.
Right. And what I'll do also on the show notes for this interview, I'll provide links to Amazon, to Class on Demand, so people can hunt you down and partake in the wisdom you've so willingly shared with the rest of us.
Well, thanks, man. And anybody that's out there listening and has any of those books or DVDs, if you want to hop on Amazon and write what you feel, go ahead. And even if it's bad, I appreciate that. I love constructive criticism. Please give it to me. If you want to give it to me in person, I will give you my direct email address. It's very simple. I welcome people writing to me. My email is very simple. It's my first name at mylastname.com. That's steve@hullfish, HULLFISH.com. Write to me and tell me what I did wrong.
Or what you did right.
Or what I did right. Or how you have been able to
benefit
and make a ton of money off of me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Steve, thanks a lot. Really has been a pleasure speaking with you.
Great talking to you, Patrick. And as usual, Tao of Color is my favorite thing to do on a Sunday morning.
All right. The newsletter plug. Love it. Thanks, man.
Talk to you later. Bye.
And that wraps up our interview. Thanks for listening. This is a continuing series. To be alerted of our next episode, subscribe to our RSS feed, our free weekly newsletter, or soon via iTunes. These links and show notes can be found at taoofcolor.com. That's all one word. Tao, T-A-O of color.com. Or if you prefer, Dao, D-A-O of color.com. This is your host, Patrick Inhofer. Thanks for listening.